This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Anne Sexton committed suicide in 1974. For some of her fans, her death added to her tragic mystique. My guest is the poet's daughter, Linda Gray Sexton. After writing several novels, she's written a new memoir about growing up with a mother who was an inspired poet, but mentally ill. As a young woman, Linda says she fled from her mother's dramatics and pain and couldn't bear to be around her. Now in her early 40s, 20 years after her mother's suicide, Linda says she's trying to get back to her mother. Her new memoir is called Searching for Mercy Street. I asked Linda to read a letter her mother wrote to her when Linda was a girl.
Dear Linda, I am in the middle of a flight to St. Louis to give a reading. I was reading a New Yorker story that made me think of my mother, and all alone in the seat, I whispered to her, "I know, Mother, I know." And I thought of you, someday flying somewhere all alone, and me dead perhaps, and you wishing to speak to me. And I want to speak back. Linda, maybe it won't be flying. Maybe it will be at your own kitchen table, drinking tea some afternoon when you are 40. Any time, I want to say back. First, I love you. Second, you never let me down. Third, I know I was there once. I, too, was 40, and with a dead mother whom I needed still. This is my message to the 40-year-old Linda. No matter what happens, you were always my bobolink, my special Linda Gray. Life is not easy. It is awfully lonely. I know that. Now you know it, too. Wherever you are, Linda, talking to me. But I've had a good life. I wrote unhappy, but I lived to the hilt. You too, Linda, live to the hilt, to the top. I love you, 40-year-old Linda, and I love what you do, what you feel, what you are. Be your own woman. Belong to those you love. Talk to my poems or talk to your heart. I'm in both if you need me. I lied, Linda. I did love my mother, and she loved me. She never held me, but I miss her so that I have to deny I ever loved her, or she me. Silly Anne. So there. Hugs and kisses. Mom.
Linda, when did your mother write that letter?
She wrote that letter when I was a teenager. I believe I was 16. And I received it, but I did not allow myself to really take it in. And I put it at the back of a drawer in a strong box that held all my most precious things. And I rediscovered it a month after her suicide.
And what did it mean to you then when you rediscovered it?
Well, initially, I had no memory of ever having seen it. And this story is the way I begin Searching for Mercy Street, telling the story of reaching out and finding it and at first being frightened by it and not knowing whether or not it was in fact a suicide note, and rereading it, realizing it was a letter I had received as a teenager. At the time my mother died, I was 21, so some years had passed, and that I had kind of blocked it from my mind, because in this letter she is already talking about a time when she'll be dead. And it's directed to me at 40 years old, and I was 21 at the time, and it seemed very far away and very frighteningly far away.
So what does the letter mean to you now that you're a little over 40?
Well, it's a very, it makes me sad. It's hard to read without crying, but it makes me feel very loved, and there's so much affirmation in the letter for who I am and what I do, and, you know, I always, in my mind, see my mother riding around in the sky writing this letter because she was on an airplane to give a reading. And I just have this vision of her kind of watching over me up there. And I talk to her up there very often.
When you rediscovered this letter, forgetting that you had read it years before, you thought maybe it was her suicide note. I take it she never really left a suicide note.
No, she did not. And we were all sort of surprised because as everyone who's read her poetry knows, you know, she spoke so frankly of so many personal and private things, and yet here is a woman who put her whole life into words, and then she left her life without a word. It was hard not to, you know, to accept that there was no final note.
Do you think it was maybe because she expected to be rescued?
No, I think that she meant business. She had always before, when she had attempted suicide, she had done it with overdoses of various medications. And the day that she killed herself, she shut herself in the garage and left the car running.
You know, I think many of her mother's fans identified with her madness and even identified with her suicide, much as many of Sylvia Plath's readers did. But I think her madness, her suicide, had such a different meaning for you as her daughter than it did for people who were looking at her life from a great distance.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because really one of my main motivations in writing the book was I had this tremendous desire to strip away the myth that surrounds her, her life as a poet. People, I think, particularly her fans, tend to see, you know, they envision her as a depressed person hunched over a typewriter with a whiskey bottle at her elbow, creating great art. And the truth of the matter was, when she was very depressed, she rarely wrote at all. And so the depression took an enormous toll on her life as an artist, as a woman, and particularly on our life as a family. And one of the points I wanted to make, that really depression was her enemy, not her muse.
You think some people might have almost romanticized your mother's depression, but because of her illness, she sometimes had to send you away as a child because she was too sick to take care of you. And then when you got a little bit older, there were times when she wanted you to be her mother. You would play a game called Playing Nine. How would that go?
How would the game go?
Yeah.
The game itself was usually on a Sunday morning. We would have gone to church. Joy and I would have gone to church with a neighbor. And Mother would still be in bed. Daddy liked to call her a pad rat because she really liked to sleep a lot. And we had a family joke that she went to St. Mattress every Sunday. But in any case, so I would come home and she'd want to cuddle, and so I'd climb in. And I was 9 at this time. And what she would do is slide down in the bed so that her head was on my chest. And then she would pretend she was the child and I was the mother. And she would slip back in time to her own childhood with her Nana, who was her most adored adult, the one she felt she could really rely on. And they used to, obviously, cuddle a lot, and this she found very comforting. But unfortunately for me, recreating this experience was very anxiety-provoking because sometimes she'd want to do this for an hour or an hour and a half, and I would become frightened. No child at 9 wants to be the mother. You know, a 9-year-old child needs to be the child. So these were very, very painful memories and really traumatic ones, I think.
My guest is writer Linda Gray Sexton. Her new book is a memoir about life with her mother, the poet Anne Sexton. It's called Searching for Mercy Street. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Linda Gray Sexton. Her new book is a memoir called Searching for Mercy Street, My Journey Back to My Mother, Anne Sexton. So much of your professional life has been bound up with your mother, too, because you've edited several volumes of her poems, a collection of her letters. You found a biographer to write her story, and now you've written a memoir about growing up with your mother. Back when you were 21, I think it was, your mother asked you to be her literary executor, to handle her literary estate. How did you feel about that?
I was not pleased. I saw it as her attempt to draw me back in, and I had at that point, you know, moved out on my own and felt that I was somewhat independent, and I didn't want to get drawn back into her life and her work. I was trying so hard at that point to establish my own identity. So basically, she appealed to my vanity. She said, "You're the only one who can do this," and I said, "Well, what about Maxine Kuhman, who was another poet and her best friend?" And she explained to me that there was a lot of value to having the literary executor be a family member, because if there were any crises that came up over deciding what should be published or what should go where, anything like that, a family member was better suited. So basically, I gave in. I extracted from her, an agreement that I would be paid, because I saw that I would have to take time off from my own work. So that was kind of my way of drawing a line. And my reaction at the time was one of dismay, and yet on the other hand, a certain kind of exhilaration because it gave me a role, you know, to play. And that was one of the things Mother was so good at, figuring out what your weak spot was.
There are many difficult decisions you've had to make over the years as the literary executor of your mother's estate. I imagine one of the most difficult was this. There were recordings of psychiatric sessions she had when she was in therapy in the 1960s, and you made the decision to release recordings and transcriptions of those sessions to your mother's biographer, Diane Middlebrook. Was that a difficult decision for you to make?
I don't think that it was difficult, although there was no decision that I took lightly. Mother herself had placed the tape recordings and the transcriptions of the tape recordings that were in her possession into the archive that she had indicated to me should go to a university library to be used for scholarly and biographical use, so that when further tape recordings became available via the doctor who had made the recordings, I simply followed suit with the rest of them. But I felt Mother herself made the decision.
Did she have a different standard of privacy than you did or than the rest of the family did?
Yes. Not than I did, but certainly than the rest of the family did, and in fact, perhaps more than most of the public does. There's a wonderful line from a poem called "For John, Who Begs Me Not to Inquire Further," who was one of her first mentors and who was quite shocked. He was a poet, John Holmes. He was quite shocked at the revelations she was making in her poetry. And in this poem, she explains herself by saying, "At first it was private, then it was more than myself." And I think that is sort of a nifty way to explain what went through her mind. You know, her motto really was that a writer's job is to dig deep into painful things and then to hold those things up before society so that society can see itself better. And that is the way in which we transcend individual experience and do our job as writers at illuminating things. I think that for the rest of the family, it's hard. It's very difficult, in fact, because most people who are involved with public figures don't, and certainly my father didn't bargain on, you know, essentially having my mother become a famous poet and then having a variety of the personal details of their life revealed.
What was it like for you to learn about how your mother felt about you from listening to tapes that she recorded with her psychiatrist?
It was pretty devastating because the material that's contained in those tapes, I had always prided myself on being my mother's favorite and her friend because from the time that I was 9 on, she relied on me for many things. And yet, in the very beginning when I was a baby, she resented me because she felt she couldn't take care of me. And there was a lot of really painful revelatory material in some of this, some of these tape recordings and transcriptions, and even correspondence back and forth with the psychiatrist. And I had to go through all of that. Of course, it was part of my job as literary executor. It's part of what I'd said I would do.
Give us an example of something that you learned from the tapes that shocked you.
Well, when I was very little, my sister, I had gone back and forth many times to my grandmother's homes when my mother was too ill to take care of me, and my sister stayed at my grandmother's home for quite some time. And there were, you know, many times where she would just sit me in front of a television set while she was, mother would, sit me in front of a television set while she was typing away, or she talked a lot about hitting me and hating me because I was interrupting her, and she just, all she wanted to do was write because writing was the only thing that made her feel not crazy. That was really tough, you know. That kind of thing is, you want to know that your parents love you. And I know intellectually that it was her sickness, but when I was reading those things, I felt almost as if I were being hit again.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about your mother's illness and the problems that caused in your relationship. What were some of the special things about having such a gifted woman as your mother? Did she often show you her writing, and were you excited by her writing and by her sharing it with you?
Oh, it was the most magical part of the relationship. As I got to be a teenager, or even 11, 12, I would come home after school, and she would have been, of course, working during the day, and she would sit with me at the kitchen table, and we would drink tea and talk about her poems. And then as time went on and I began to write poetry too, we would share them back and forth. And what was so wonderful about her is that she never made me feel stupid when I didn't understand something. She took what I said very seriously, and that enabled me really to grow as a listener and as a reader. So that was a really enormous gift.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Linda Gray Sexton's new memoir is called Searching for Mercy Street, My Journey Back to My Mother, Anne Sexton. This is Fresh Air.